Hi, Babe Emery here. This is, for the record, program number 1343, Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 17. Boy, they are adding up. And this is being recorded on August 18th of the year 2024. And once again, it is my pleasure and it is my privilege to reintroduce to the audience my new co-host, Monty. And we were talking about, surprise, surprise, the past and the present, Monty. I've said several times in these broadcasts, and I've said in the past that for a younger person, and that, you know, I'm a lot older than most people, for a younger person to understand the world they're living in, you have to understand the real facts about two events that are inextricably linked. One is the assassination of President Kennedy, and the other is the Second World War. And that seems like, you know, well, boy, there goes Dave again talking about World War II, and he thinks everybody's a Nazi, and he thinks everybody's a fascist, and Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy, and blah, 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 blah. And no, actually, that is not the case. And one of the things we did, we began on 1341 reading an op-ed piece from the New York Times in which a book endorsed with a jacket endorsement by J.B. Vance not only labels their political opponents as unhuman, a variation of the Nazi subhuman, but specifically it rejects democracy as a means of developing a better solution to things, and it explicitly references Francisco Franco and his negation of democracy and the actions he took. And as we have also seen so many times in the talks we've had, Monty, and also in the talks on the Patreon site, which people can interact with you, Franco's Spain and the fascism of World War II, what happened after World War II, and what has taken place up to this, they are inextricably linked. And when we see a book lauding Francisco Franco being touted by the Republican candidate for vice president, J.B. Vance, it is something we should take note of, because as William Faulkner said, the past is never been buried. It isn't even past. And in our last conversation, we were talking about some narco-terror networks that were inextricably linked with the U.S. intelligence and national security establishment, and which comprised a significant element in the assassination of JFK, as Garrett Underhill, who was familiar with that network, opined in a state of considerable distress, and then Garrett, or Gary Underhill, as he was known, was found with two bullet holes in the back of his head, made with his left hand when he was right-handed. So that, I think, is an example of counter-diplomacy, so to speak. So, Monty, people have been listening to me run my yap here. Let's go back, and maybe people think that, you know, some of the talk about Max Aiken von Hohenlohe and things going on in Habsburg land, so to speak, things going on in Spain, things going on in Czechoslovakia vis-a-vis the Sudetenland and Neville Chamberlain, and then things going on in Mexico City with regard to the assassination of JFK, and that very same Max Aiken von Hohenlohe, cited by Ray Luca as very possibly the Nazi whom Jim Garrison was pursuing in his case, and he was in from Hohenlohe, inextricably linked with Wynne Scott, the Mexico City station chief, an individual with whom he had been networking when Scott was with the OSS, when Max Aiken von Hohenlohe after the war, with Scott in the SSU, and that networking continued right up to the present time. So, Augusto Pinochet, I think about the Masters Tournament, which takes place before too much longer, or maybe it just did, I've forgotten which. And also Francisco Franco, and why those things in a book cited positively by the vice presidential candidate for the Republican Party are not things to be taken lightly, and they are, in fact, significantly linked to the political developments that we have been chronicling.
Absolutely. I should note that in our last program together, we left off on a letter that Otto Skorzeny, who's a chief of Nazi Special Forces activities, wrote to Monsignor Montini, correct?
Yep. Giovanni Battista Montini, I think his formal title was Secretary of State for the Vatican. He handled
correct.
Those functions. And later he became better known as Pope Paul VI. So, yes.
Right. He was Secretary of State of the Vatican and ultimately their Minister of Foreign Affairs in 1951, 52, and 53 when these letters were written between Skorzeny. I'd just like to give a peripheral example of how complex the Skorzeny network was in terms of its stay-behind army and ultimately its connections to the Republican power base in the United States of America in 1951.
That will work. Amade, do you think it would be fair to say that Montini was more linked with the rat lines and the post-World War II Nazi diaspora than any high-ranking Vatican official? Father Druganovich, I think, was the main Catholic prelate involved. But I think Montini would have been the highest ranking Vatican official.
Yes, structural Vatican official. However, I should note that Reinhard Heydrich, as a commander of the Reich's main security command, Risha, Heydrich had an official within the Vatican by the name of Albert Hartel. And let me get the proper spelling on that real quick, because this is a point of conjecture I've noted with people that researched this phenomena of the commingling of, first half of 20th century fascism in the Vatican, but let me see if I can't find his name real quick. I believe it's in an SSU document, Albert Hartel. Let me see. Let's see. Okay, yes, Albert Hartel, last name spelled H-A-R-T-L. And I'm just reading a quick blurb from his Wikipedia because it does, in fact, dovetail with the SSU documents, which are quite extensive. That's for those listeners that don't know, that's the Strategic Services Unit. It was an interim organization between the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, and the CIA.
And it was the organ which permitted Winscott to continue the network with Max Eggen von Hohenlohe after they originally began doing it under OSS.
Right, correct.
And I think Hartel's name would be pronounced Hartel. I don't think of like Hartel, like an E. I think
Hartel. Correct.
Hartel would be the proper pronunciation. So tell us about Mrs. Hartel's baby boy.
Well, I won't go into his seminary background, but he was, in fact, ordained in 1929 by the Archbishop of Munich, Cardinal Michael von Falber. And he began teaching at the Friesling Seminary in Munich. But ultimately, by 1933, he was a full-fledged informant of the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, and he was a protege of Reinhard Heydrich, one of his closest associates, and he helped establish the Sicherheitsdienst. This is an actual nomenclature. I know it sounds bizarre, but Hartel was the commander of something within the Sicherheitsdienst, the SD, called the Chief of Church Information. And he was tasked by Reinhard Heydrich to collect information about party members that had close associations with either ministers or deputy ministers within the foreign affairs staff of the Vatican, of which Pope Pius VI at this time, Monsignor Montini, had connections with. It should also be noted that he was also the commander of Department 4, Bravo 4. So that's Department 4, Bravo 4, of which Adolf Eichmann was his deputy. So Albert Hartel was not only the commander of church information for the Sicherheitsdienst, he was also commander of all the Jewish affairs staffs with Adolf Eichmann as his deputy for the Gestapo. No.
So let me interrupt this part, but this is not known to me. By the way, the Sicherheitsdienst, or SD, is the SS Intelligence Service. Now, Hartl was actually a deputy, or rather, Eichmann was a deputy to Hartl. Am I correct in assuming that means Hartl actually outranked him?
100%. Albert Hartl was, by all accounts, a general in the SS, an SS Gruppenführer. According to his SSU documents and his, actually there's a CIG document as well, so Central Intelligence Group, another predecessor to the CIA. According to his SSU CIG documents, Albert Hartl was in fact the superior officer to Adolf Eichmann. So if you were looking at the chain of command within, Department 4, Bravo 4, which was Jewish affairs for the Gestapo, the chain of command would have gone Eichmann, Albert Hartl, and then Reinhard Heydrich. So Eichmann was a deputy to Hartl within the Jewish affairs staff.
And that is ascending. So it would go Eichmann, and who was a colonel, to Hartl, who was a general in the SS, or Sicherheitsdienst right. in this case, on up to Reinhard Heydrich, who was the head of the Sicherheitsdienst until he was assassinated. I think it was 1942.
Correct. Real quick, I just want to note that Hartl also had a very fascinating and very disturbing deputy on the Eastern Front, because Hartl wasn't just the commander of the Church intelligence staff, and he wasn't just the commander of the Gestapo's Jewish affairs staff outside of Greater Germany, which of course was Department 4, Bravo 4. He also had a deputy by the name of, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher the last name here, a Blobel, B-L-O-B-E-L, Paul Blobel, who was a Sicherheitsdienst commander on the Eastern Front, and ultimately the deputy commander of Einsatzgruppen Charlie, which was a mobile death squad that oversaw the massacre at Babi Yar, which was one of the mass murder sites of Romani people during the Nazi occupation of Kiev. And that took place in September of 1941.
The Einsatzgruppen were the SS mobile killing squads that followed the frontline troops into Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. And by and large, there may be some exceptions, the ones who were executed at Nuremberg or afterward, but by and large, the leaders of the Einsatzgruppen went to work directly or indirectly in some cases for U.S. intelligence in the West after the war.
Correct. And it should be noted that Albert Hartl is no exception to that. By all accounts, he did in fact become a Russian intelligence expert for the CIA, serving under his superior officer, who was Minister of Foreign Information and Propaganda, and ultimately one of the top commanders of the Einsatzgruppen on the Eastern Front, a SS Obergruppenführer by the name of Franz Alfred Six, who was Albert Hartl's commander in Einsatzgruppen Charlie on the Eastern Front.
And so, Six was sprung from the defendant's dock at Nuremberg by John J. McCloy, who was the U.S. Commissioner of High German, the U.S. High Commissioner for Germany at the time, and later, along with Alan Dulles, a major player in these same concatenations, he was a member of the Warren Report. So Blobel, B-L-O-B-E-L, I may be mispronouncing that, he was commander of the Einsatzgruppe that did the liquidations at Babi Yar.
Correct. And Albert Hartl, as the Minister of Church Information, was the commander of Einsatzgruppen Charlie, which was the parent unit to Paul Blobel's Einsatzgruppen, actually had the code name Sonderaktion 1005, or Special Action Battalion 1005, which was actually a top secret Nazi unit under Operation Reinhard that operated on the Eastern Front, whose task it was to actually dig up mass graves and burn the bodies to make sure that nobody would find proof of what the Nazis had done on the Eastern Front. And ultimately, that was a joint operation between Reinhard Heydrich and Heinrich Müller, who was the head of the Gestapo, who personally gave the orders to Albert Hartel and Blobel to initiate these mass, ulminations and then burnings of bodies on the Eastern Front. Tens of thousands of men, women, and children were dug up from their graves on the Eastern Front, primarily in Ukraine, outside of the city of Kiev, where something like 30,000 men, women, and children were buried in a mass grave during the Kiev Babi Yar massacre. Thank you. Something like 30,000 men, women, and children were dug up out of the Babi Yar ravine outside of Kiev under the orders of Heydrich and, of course, Heinrich Müller, the head of Gestapo. And it was a massive cover-up operation. You know,
I just want to break in ever so briefly. Babi Yar is a very famous site of the Einsatzgruppen massacres.
Right.
It was commemorated in a poem by Yevgeny Yevtushenko. And then after the Maidan coup, Petro Poroshenko was laying flowers in memory of the OUNB. The Einsatzgruppen generally took advantage of local fascists like the OUNB people or the UPA in Ukraine or the Ustashi in Croatia and others elsewhere. But they were commanded by SS officers. And the grotesque historical irony of Petro Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine at the time,
right,
weighing flowers in memory of the OUNB when the OUNB comprised the UPA, the executioners by and large at Babi Yar. They staffed the Ukrainian security police who did that. And one of the things that I find infuriating and past the point, Monty, frankly, stunning, is the silence on the part of world Jewry about what's going on in Ukraine. I mean, maybe they're stunned by what's going on in Gaza. I mean, that's appalling. But the people in power in Ukraine, the people being celebrated, being nominated as heroes of Ukraine, and that's what people like Yaroslav Stetsko, Roman Shukevich, Semyon Petliura, and others, Stefan Bandera, they were the people who perpetrated, by and large, the Holocaust of bullets. I mean, we got to remember, you know, one hears this refrain, we got to remember the Holocaust. Well, so much of that Holocaust took place in Ukraine, and the people being lauded by Western media are the heirs to the OUNB organizations there. There's an essay on my website by Carl Oglesby called The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt, and it talks about how the OUNB were a part of the cadre of the Galen organization. But it's
right,
those Jews who are, frankly, waving the blue and yellow flag and going, I stand with Ukraine, blah, 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 in effect, not literally, obviously, but in effect, in substance, they are, if not actual accessories after the fact and the Holocaust of bullets, certainly they are themselves the assassins of memory in that regard. So, Monsieur Blobel and Monsieur Hartel, Monsieur Eichmann, Reinhard Heydrich, and this whole concatenation with the Vatican and fascism. Continue, Monty.
Yes, and it should also be appreciated that as the commander, before I pivot back to, Republican Party politics and how this overlaps with it, it should be noted that according to SSU documents, which I will post at a later date, according to SSU documents on Albert Hartel, as the chief of church information for the SD, he ran a rather complex spy network within the Vatican, which included many prominent members, including the aforementioned Monsignor Montini, later Pope Paul VI. And this is just the reality of it. And for those listeners that have, a bit of an issue with me talking about senior members of the Vatican working as Nazi spies, I would turn their attention to the case of OSS officer William Goren, last name spelled G-O-W-E-N, who actually gave evidence in a case of survivors suing the Catholic Church, claiming that Monsignor Montini was a willing agent in the death of stolen victims' monies and assets and in the escape of Croatian Nazis, specifically the commander of the Ustashi. So ultimately, that is the reality that I am citing here. I mean, these aren't just in my own defense, Dave. I mean, these aren't my own musings. I'm not some, anti-Catholic, revanchist. I mean, this is the reality.
Of course. Something that in that regard, we've spoken at great length. In fact, I did a whole series of shows, long AFA programs, about the shooting of the Pope, but we've talked about the P2 Lodge, about fascism in the Vatican, what grew out of that. And I think it's important to distinguish between the Catholic Church and the Vatican. There's a difference between the United States and the White House, for example. But Vatican politics are inextricably linked with fascism and the heroic work of John Loftus, among others, in the book The Secret War Against the Jews. The Ballaro Secret later, and the uncensored version, America's Nazi Secret, and also Unholy Trinity, both Secret War Against the Jews and Unholy Trinity, co-authored with Mark Ahrens. So there is a lot of information about this, and John Loftus really did a heroic job in chronicling this and braving some very, very fierce headwinds, professional headwinds, in so doing.
I would have to agree. Unfortunately, this is the path that the most researchers who look at this phenomena end up having to follow, and it's a very difficult path. But pivoting to Republican politics for a moment, I should like to comment before I jump forward to the Nixon administration and what they were trying to accomplish with a man by the name of Rupert Murdoch, who is at one point Richard Nixon's chief of communications, all right, for the administration.
Now, was Rupert Murdoch, is this the guy who became the huge publishing magnate?
Correct.
Oh, man, I didn't realize he actually had an official position with the Nixon administration.
Right. He was, let me get his official designator real quick here. I believe it's, let's see, Keith Rupert Murdoch. What did he do in the Nixon administration? He had a very interesting position here. Let me see.
I bet he did. I bet he did.
I apologize to the listeners if I'm being a bit sluggish here, but ultimately I'm trying to draw a direct correlation between Rupert Murdoch and the Spanish fascists and the Staff D entity of the CIA, which is ultimately why I mentioned all of those elements and the previous program. But for Pete's sake, why am I being so why is my computer being so slow here?
It happens. One of the things while you're digging up his exact title, the professional momentum of having these people who were actual Nixon spear carriers in the media,
right,
and then they become lords of the press, as the late George Sully's termed them, like Rupert Murdoch, and they control Fox News, they control the Wall Street Journal, and so many other things. They control what it is that people are thinking. And it's not a little thing at all. It's a very, very, very big thing.
Well, yeah, of course. And along those lines, before I get cleared up with Rupert Murdoch here, I mean, one of his, acolytes, or I should say one of his, I would be an acolyte because he was chairman and CEO of Fox News, Roger Ailes. People tend to forget that, back in the 70s, Roger Ailes was an employee of Television News Incorporated, which of course was a syndicated television news film service that was completely owned by Joseph Coors. And, of course, we know that Joseph and Adolph Coors of the Coors Brewing Company, my goodness. I mean, they are intrinsic to right-wing politics. I mean, he was a founding member of the Heritage Foundation, along with Paul Weyrich and Edwin Fuller. And of course, organizations like Council for National Policy, which is one of the most rabid anti-LGBTQ plus organizations in the United States. I mean, that is a wholly owned entity of the Coors Foundation, so it's just very disturbing that the intersectionality between Fox News, Rupert Murdoch, Roger Ailes, and the Nixon administration. Okay, yes, I just found his official title. He was the last a cabinet minister for communications under Richard Nixon. Okay, so that was his position within the Nixon White House right before he stepped down.
And, before Nixon stepped down, you mean?
Yeah, correct, before Nixon stepped down. So it's very interesting, that connection right there. But I'd like to pivot back again to 1951 with an interesting entity that Richard Nixon helped set up. It's something called the Western Tube Corporation out of California.
Oh, and, yes, wonderful. Yeah. Nikolai Maloxa's enterprise. Go ahead.
Right. It was founded by Nikolai Maloxa, who he has a rather extensive CIA document. It goes all the way back to OSS, SSU, CIG, CIA. So ultimately, every single organization back to the OSS was concerned with Maloxa. And by all accounts, he was the top financier of the Iron Guard, which was the Romanian fascist party during the Second World War. And I'd like to quote directly from a blog post by Linda Miner, who has a rather brilliant blog that I sometimes coordinate with, called QJost, and I'll cite a link to it, but I'll just quote it because it's probably the best encapsulation of it, and it states the following. May 1951, at the height of the Korean War, when all industry was under wartime control, Maloxa organized his Western Tube Corporation. The company, of which Maloxa was treasurer and sole stock owner, $1,000 worth of stock, planned to manufacture seamless tubes for oil refining. On 17 May 1951, the Western Tube Corporation filed for a certificate of necessity to give top wartime priority to its materials and its personnel. Also, the company filed a petition for seeking, quote, first preference quota, end quote, for its treasurer, Nikolai Maloxa, on the grounds that he was indispensable for the operations of the Western Tube Corporation. These two applications were personally promoted by Senator Richard Nixon. Nixon telephoned the executive assistant of INS Commissioner James Hennessy, last name spelled H-E-N-N-E-S-S, to plead on behalf of Maloxa's permanent entry into the United States and his permanent citizenship, and a letter sent by Richard Nixon to the Defense Production Administrator of the United States Department of Defense, marked urgent, insisted, quote, "It is important strategically and economically, both for the state of California and the entire United States of America, that a plant for manufacturing of seamless tubing for oil wells be erected. Urge that every consideration may merit be given to the pending application of Mr. Maloxa," end quote.
So now, this, by the way, was during the Korean War, and presumably, correct, Western Tube was going to be manufacturing seamless stainless steel pipe or steel pipelines to basically as a conduit for oil needed for the war effort. I would mention that not only was Richard Nixon going to bat for Nikolai Maloxa, but he also went to bat for Valerian or VRL Trifa, who perhaps we can talk about later, time permitting. But it is very...
Give a real quick soundbite on Trifka. I'd appreciate that.
Sure, absolutely.
So So if you could just tell, no, if you could tell the audience real quick, Dave,
okay.
who he was.
Okay, Valerian Prita, or Vero Prita, was the head of the youth wing of the Romanian Iron Guard, the Green Shirts. He led a pogrom in Bucharest, Romania, I think it was in 1941, in which
correct.
Jews were killed and they were hung on meat hooks with signs saying carne kosher, or kosher meat. And then later he, Trifa, that is, went to work for the Gehlen organization, and he was brought into the U.S., and eventually, because the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate was deemed to be too close to the Romanian regime, which at this point was part of the Soviet bloc, basically, Trifa and some of his fellow green shirt stormtroopers literally seized control of the headquarters or the seat of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate, and eventually he became, I think his actual title was Archbishop Viorel Prita. He became the head of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate, and he was invited by Richard Nixon to give the opening prayer before the U.S. Senate, I think it was in 1955. And that is, let's just say heresy hath no bounds when we're talking about the contemporary political landscape in the U.S. I mean, that's wild. But then, you know, hell, you've got Petro Poroshenko laying wreaths in memory of the OUNB at Babi Yar. I mean, my goodness, it's surreal. And we should mention that Nicolae Malacsa was very prominent in Romania. He had a lot to do with the oil business there. And I think, as I recall, Monty, he was a business partner with Goering's brother.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad he brought that up. But Malacsa was business partners with Albert Goering, Hermann Goering's younger, I believe his younger brother, correct?
I don't know, but he was his brother.
Right. Albert Goering. And ultimately, all of the holdings of Nicolae Malacsa's mining operations in Romania. And there's quite a few of those entities, so I won't name them all off of, because simply I can't remember them off the top of my head. But he had at least five major coal and steel mining entities that actually culminated in the at least 70% of all mining operations in Romania. So he was actually primary shareholder of some of the largest mining operations in Romania. Ultimately, Albert Goering, Hermann Goering's brother, oversaw the stewardship and the ultimate ownership of all of Malacsa's mines in Romania, under something called Hermann Goering Werks, all right, of which Albert Hartel not only oversaw all of the mining operations, but as the Minister of Church Information, remember that Trifka was, in fact, involved in these Einsengruppen operations. But Malacsa also was the president of something called the Trans-Romanian Railway, later called the Malacsa Railway, which, according to SSU documents, received funding from a man by the name of Albert Sloan, who was president of General Motors. According to SSU documents, Albert Sloan fronted $10 million to Malacsa's Trans-Romanian Railway, which actually later became the conduit for transporting tens of thousands of Romanian Jews and Slavs out of the country into concentration camps like Auschwitz and Sobibor, and extermination camps like Treblinka. So the entire railway industry in Romania, owned by Nicolae Malacsa, eventually became the transportation conduit into the Nazi concentration camp system.
And by the way, Malacsa was the actual financier, the main financier of the Romanian Iron Guard per se.
Correct. And this is the same Alexa of which, Senator Richard Nixon is telephoning the executive assistant of INS telling him, look, we got to make this man a permanent resident and ultimately a citizen of the United States. And this is also the same Nicolae Malaxa that Richard Nixon is sending a letter to the chief administrator of defense production for the Department of Defense. And ultimately, a liaison officer to the American Security Council at that time, telling him, look, we need to give this company, you know, Western Tube Corporation, first bid on all oil production facilities in the United States. All oil mines in the United, or mining, or excuse me, oil drilling operations in the United States, Western Tube has to receive for the very first bid because it's strategic to the war economy during the Korean War. So that's fascinating right there that, you know, we talk about the Kennedy assassination, Dave, and certainly you've talked about it. I believe it's, Guns of November, parts 3 and 4, where you talk about, the phenomena, the dark specter of it, oil speculators like Dreyhull Bird and Jack Crichton and Clint Murchison and H.L. Hunt and the Bush dynasty through Dresser Industries and Zapata Oil. You talk about all of these oil speculators in the United States apparently having some motivation for killing President Kennedy, correct?
Yes, I think actually the discussion of the oil companies per se is in AFA program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. I read at length from some unpublished and characteristically brilliant essays by Peter Dale Scott, the Dallas Conspiracy and Government Documents in the JFK Assassination. But yes, a fascinating, I guess I've done shows I call Trouble on Oil Waters. And, that's an example. A spoiler alert, Monty, the importance of Western Tube, as set forth by Richard Nixon. By the way, Western Tube never produced any steel tubing. But the mailing address for Western Tube, drumroll fanfare, was?
Oh, it's Richard Nixon's law firm.
Julia Koop and Nixon. So if you wanted to send any sort of official correspondence to Western Tube, you send it to Richard Nixon's law firm, Julia Koop and Nixon in Whittier, California.
Right, and I'm getting to the crux of it. You know, the fact that these, you know, major oil companies like H.L. Hunt's entities, like Clint Murchison and Dreyhull Bird, you know, these major oil speculators are apparently contracting, you know, once again, I will quote the petition once again for Western Tube Corporation by Richard Nixon to the Defense Production Administrator of the Department of Defense and the American Security Council. I mean, it states, once again, it is a quote, it is important strategically and economically for both California and the entire United States of America that a plant for manufacturing seamless tubing and oil wells be erected. Urge every consideration may merit be given for pending application. And ultimately, these applications were to be given for first preference quota to the treasurer of the company, Nicolae Malaxa. Now, I have a theory as to what exactly Malaxa is doing. Continuing with this article, 1 year later, after Richard Nixon sent these letters, to the date, Nicolae Malaxa becomes a permanent resident and a citizen of the United States of America. On that very same day, Malaxa left the United States with an American passport as an American citizen and visited Juan Perón in Argentina. Nicolae Malaxa also met in Buenos Aires, according to his CIA dossier, with Otto Skorzeny, Nazi parachutist who rescued Mussolini in 1943 and chief of Nazi special forces activities. Skorzeny, now settled in Madrid, remained a close associate of other Romanian exiles, including Horia Sima, the head of the Iron Guard. It is interesting to note that sitting on the board of directors as if you want to present synchronicity to Western Tubes and Richard Nixon's holdings, it is interesting to note that the an entity called the Development Corporation of America, DCA, In the 1957 issue of Red Island News Digest, okay, discussed the creation of a railway and freight system set up by the Great Southwest Development Project between Dallas and Fort Worth, Great Southwest Railroads. The article notes that many of the figures driving the construction and management of the lines are the same ones that are running the Great Southwest RIP Large Project, which included Angus Wynn, William Zeckerdorf of Rockefeller Center, and Amon Carter, are all named. But one of the people that is involved in this entity is Arthur Rubloff, last name spelled R-U-B-L-O-F-F, of the Development Corporation of America. They were involved in a court case where they purchased the holdings completely of the Great Southwest Corporation and the Western Tube Corporation of California. So what is the importance of all this? Well, the Great Southwest Corporation later represented Marina Oswald when she was arrested by the Dallas Police Department. In fact, the Great Southwest Corporation paid for Marina Oswald's hotel bills for the 2.5 months that she was being interrogated by the FBI and the Secret Service and Army Intelligence and ultimately elements of the CIA and the FBI. But the Great Southwest Corporation also owned the hotels that the Secret Service stayed in, the Adolphus Hotel in Dallas in the night before the assassination. And by some accounts, and I'm quoting directly from the Pierre Lafitte materials that are cited within the book Who in Dallas, which is actually based off of a date book of the Calgua operative, Pierre Lafitte, the hotels that Pierre Lafitte's associates, Gerhard Leet and a man by the name of Frilio, Jean Frilio, stayed in while they were in Dallas. So it is fascinating that this corporate entity that later buys out Nikolai Malatsa's holdings within the Western Tube Corporation, the Great Southwest Corporation, it's fascinating that the Great Southwest Corporation owns the entire infrastructure of the hotels that, let's see, Marina Oswald stayed in while she's being interrogated. They owned the hotels that the Secret Service were contracted to stay in while they were protecting the president or seemingly, you know, not protecting the president. And they also owned the hotels that Jean Frilio, Jean Lafitte, and Gerhard Leet stayed in while they were in Dallas prepping for the murder of President Kennedy, if we can believe the validity of the Lafitte materials that are referenced inside of the late Hank Abarelli's coup in Dallas.
Several points of information about Monty. People can read about Malaxa and the Western Tube, or hear about it, rather, in AFA program number 2, available from on the SpitfireList.com website. And, yes, the discussion of Great Southwest Corporation and the and Marine Oswald, that does indeed come from AFA 37, and specifically I'm operating from memory here, the August 2nd installment, which I think was the second one, and also the August 30th installment called From Elm Street to Wall Street, talk about these various connections, and, who was what was the name of the military intelligence unit that was commanded by Jack Alston Crichton that's part and parcel to this?
Once again, I'm stressing that we have very few first-hand accounts other than newspaper stories that cover Jack Crichton receiving a medal for his command. I believe it's a Distinguished Service Medal that Jack Crichton earned, but for being the commander of this unit. Yes, that was called the 488th Military Intelligence Detachment, or the 488th MID. And it appears to be some kind of interim, almost National Guard-esque in its structure, military intelligence unit that on the day of the murder of President Kennedy was contracted seemingly by the city of Dallas and the Dallas Police Department specifically to augment the security detail of President Kennedy's motorcade. Yes, and Jack Crichton was the commander of that.
Fascinating. Something else I want to bring to people's attention. Now, I talked about Mr. Lafitte and Filio, the Free Cagoule veterans, the Cagoule, C-A-G-O-U-L-E, being the French fascist group. They wore hoods like the Ku Klux Klan, and they were involved in an abortive coup in 1938 in France, and later became a key element of the Vichy milieu. Some of them went into the Charlemagne division, Waffen-SS, but in, for the record, 1222, in which I discuss and excerpt some material from the book Coup in Dallas by the late Hank Alparelli, one of the most, if not the most compelling evidence to my mind, being that this is a Dave Emery observation,
sure.
that the material in Coup in Dallas, and I'm not saying it's all absolutely, bedrock, but, there were some operatives for the Office of Special Investigations. That was the Justice Department unit in charge with investigating Nazi war criminals in the U.S. And the aforementioned John Loftus was heavily involved with that. And they were given information about Monsieur Lafitte, Filio, and Leet being in Dallas, Texas, in around the time of November 22nd, 1963.
Right.
And this was in the 1990s, okay, 30-plus years later. And they did not want their names printed in the book. Now, that, to me, the aforementioned brilliant Peter Dale Scott formulated a principle that, quote, the cover-up obviates the conspiracy, unquote. And the fact that those OSI operatives were not willing to go on the record with their names 30-plus years after the events in Dallas says to me that they were afraid of the then, this is in the 1990s, of the contemporary capability for these operatives, for these interests, for these forces to wreak mayhem in decades after the Kennedy assassination. In other words, it wasn't long ago and far away. It was very au courant as of the 90s, au courant enough or current enough to, for these operatives to insist on speaking on condition of anonymity. And I think that's very profound and something that has been overlooked by the many critics of the book Coup in Dallas. And as I said before, there are some egregious, almost fifth grade or fourth grade level editorial mistakes in that book, but those, because it was rushed into print, but those editorial mistakes notwithstanding, it's a very valuable book. And when we talk about Nazis, and people say, oh, there goes Dave again, talk about Nazis and the Kennedy assassination, that book is a very, stands in testament to that. And the fact, again, Marty, that those OSI operatives cited in Coup in Dallas, in connection with Mr. Lafitte, Filio, and Leet in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963, or at that time period, the fact that they would not speak on the record unless it was on the condition of anonymity says volumes to me. Continue, please.
Right. you know, what the hell can I say? I mean, we're looking at an environment of how could I put it? I mean, it's, you know, people wonder how an operation like murdering the president can take place with so many people being involved and they all keep quiet. Well, it's silence or death. You know, I mean, that's ultimately the environment that these men operate in. You know, if they talk, they're dead. End of story. You know,
it's the old saying, it can be truly said that treason doth never succeed, because when it doth succeed, none dare call it treason. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So ultimately, it appears, you know, going back to Nikolai Mlotsa and his connections with the Nixon administration, or I should say a Senator Nixon, and the events leading up to him becoming Vice President Nixon under Eisenhower. The way I interpret all of that is that it appears that Richard Nixon is allowing the Western Tube Corporation to be used as a front for financing covert operations that Nikolai Malaxa is willing to bankroll. Because I see no purpose for Malaxa getting involved with Otto Skorzeny, in such a short time period after, one, he becomes, a U.S. citizen, and then two, he receives these wonderful contracts from the Department of Defense as treasurer of the company. And then ultimately, as you pointed out, he doesn't produce anything through his manufacturing of purported seamless tubing for oil wells. He ultimately doesn't produce anything. So what is happening here? I mean, what is this entity? Why does he make concessions with the Peron government and then ultimately meetings with Otto Skorzeny? In all likelihood, the entire entity of the Western Tube Corporation is in fact a front for covert actions in order to finance covert operations. That's just my theory. I don't know how you feel about that, Dave, but
yeah, Mommy, I think your hypothesis makes a lot of sense. Whether or not that was what was intended, I don't know, but it certainly is what I would call food for thought and grounds for further research.
Yeah, it appears that, going back to world commerce before, once again, I keep on nodding to this pivot that we're going to be making towards, Franco Spain and the Trump administration. But ultimately it appears that in October of 1948, when the World Commerce Corporation is created, that was based out of the 20th floor of the 25th Broad Street building in Manhattan. 25 Broad Street was also known as the Broad Exchange Building, which was associated with the New York Stock Exchange, and it was housed at a time at the Curb Exchange. You know, the building's owner until 1940 was the Board Exchange Company, and subsequently it was owned from 1940 to 1945 by Prudential, which was a financial and insurance giant. And then in 1945, the World Commerce Corporation based their affiliates out of 25 Broad Street Exchange. So it was purchased by City Investing Company, which was a front for world commerce. And the only reason why I mention all that is because the man that leased the space for the World Commerce Corporation was a man by the name of Charles F. Noyes Company. Or excuse me, it was an entity called Charles F. Noyes Company, which itself was a vehicle for a prominent New York high-powered real estate operative by the name of Charles Noyes, last name spelled N-O-Y-E-S. And it appears that Noyes started his career as an advisor for Chemical Bank in New York. Now, the listeners to these conversations we've been having will remember that Chemical Bank is the firm that is providing all of the funding to the OUN Bandera operatives under Aerodynamic that are facilitating the movement of DRE anti-Castro Cubans into the 8th World Youth Festival in Helsinki. So ultimately, the man that owned the building for the original World Commerce Corporation, which I've referenced being involved in Southeast Asian Supply Corporation and Paul Helliwell's Castle Bank, and ultimately Red Sunset Enterprises, which was a front for paying off elements of Brigade 2506, the Bay of Pigs invasion operatives. It should be noted that the owner of the building that the World Commerce Corporation was based in was a financial advisor to Chemical Bank, the exact same bank that the DRE is being funded by the OUN fascists when they go into Helsinki in 1962. So that is fascinating. Ultimately, City Investing Company, the parent company to Charles F. Noyes Corporation, on their board of directors was Robert Golett, last name spelled G-O-E-L-E-T, who in 1972 became the chairman of the board of Air America. So you see this bizarre overlap between World Commerce Corporation, Chemical Bank, which once again was the paymaster conduit to the DRE when they went into Helsinki through a OUN Bandera rat line, but also a man who would become chairman of the board of the Air America Corporation, which, by all accounts, I don't think it would be wrong to classify Air America as a supply line for CIA financed narco terror operations in Southeast Asia. Call me out on that, Dave, if I'm incorrect in that.
No, I think that's accurate, and I think I would not call these associations bizarre at all, but rather, you know, functional slash operational, and to be understood as being in the context of what they were doing, business as usual.
Right. Skipping forward a little bit in this narrative, I don't know if your listening audience is aware of a man by the name of David Baird, last name spelled Baird. I don't know if your listening audience or you yourself have been made aware of his activities in this time period and how they overlap.
The name is not familiar to me. We've got just under 4 minutes left, Almighty. So maybe you can give us a quick teaser about Mr. Baird, and then we'll continue with this at Gleeful Lake on our next show.
Well, essentially, he was a speculator for the defense intelligence and the oil industry and how they overlap in the production of weaponry. And without getting too into detail, I will demonstrate how his clients not only overlap into the Great Southwest Corporation, into World Commerce Corporation, into the Western Tube Corporation, but ultimately appear to be the action arm of the Republican National Heritage Foundation and their emigre efforts in the 1950s and 60s. So I suppose we'll leave that to a later, the next program that we do, Dave.
Very quickly, and we've spoken about that in the past, that was the brainchild or the brainstorm, the inspiration came from Alan Dulles. It was overseen by drumroll fanfare Richard Nixon. The chief spokesperson
right.
for it was Ronald Reagan. The guy who handled the State Department machinations to bring these people into the country was William Casey, in charge of secret intelligence in Germany in 1944, 1945, operating at the behest of Alan Dulles. And the guy who instituted that then made it a permanent part of the Republican Party, it had previously coalesced only during election years, was George H.W. Bush. All of them prominent names. Casey, of course, was Ronald Reagan's campaign manager and later his director of the CIA, and along with Alan Weinstein, set up the National Endowment for Democracy, a misnomer if ever there was one, the most important regime change arm of the federal government. So that is the context for the Republican Ethnic Outreach Heritage Council, or was it Republican Heritage Outreach Council? A wonderfully benign name.
Right. Essentially a front or a holding entity for, what can I say, several men that were involved in Einsatzgruppen operations on the Eastern Front.
It's a front for the, it's a Republican Nazi front. In any event, this concludes For the Record program number 1343, Conversations with Monty. This has been conversation number 17. This is being recorded on August 18th of the year 2024. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.